Sorry we destroyed Mother Earth. We got addicted to their juice. And then we had no choice but to dig and dig and dig. And now we're looking for some place to go. Somewhere peaceful with greens and blues. Something like we once had before we destroyed you. Well, we've got the Mother Earth destruction blues. Too long we covered our eyes and ears like fools. We pretended we didn't see, but now we do. Glub, 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 glub. We got the Mother Earth destruction blues. Sorry, Mama, but what more can we do? We had a fine party at the cost of you. We got the Mother Earth destruction blues. The time to leave is coming soon. Don't miss the last spaceship or you're doomed. We got the Mother Earth destruction blues. Floating through space with no home to go to. Looking out the porthole, thinking just what did we do? No, yeah, we got the Mother Earth destruction blues.
Oh, yes, we do.
We got the Mother Earth destruction blues. We used to sing with joy, but now we sing the blues.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and many other wonderful programs if you're in the Sacramento area at 96.5 FM. If you're just joining us, we're listening to The Economy of the Underground People. The underground economy is where drug wars and police lockdowns meet urban America. Tom Ashbrook talks to Alice Goffman.
So kind of service industry that is for those who are inhibited by what parole terms, let's say.
Exactly. So I met Javon when he was 8, and by the time he was like a very charismatic young boy, and by the time he was 13, his voice broke, and then he was able to impersonate his older relatives with like amazing accuracy. So he would do these impersonations of like movie stars or like his older cousin or his uncle. So one day Reggie is talking to me about his parole requirements, how he has to come home at 8 o'clock at night every night, and he really resents this because he's been locked up most of his life and he's just come home and now he can't go out after 8 o'clock, and he's fallen in love with this young woman a few blocks away. He really wants to go see her. She works until 8, so he can't go see her. So he's talking about living under the strain of these requirements, and Javon comes up to him and he's like, I could take that parole call for you, you know? Like, I could answer all the questions from the parole officer. I could do your voice better than everybody.
Okay.
Exactly. So Reggie's like, well, hold on. Okay, what's my date of birth, you know? And Javon tells him, and he's like, okay, what was the first case I caught, you know? He's like, for weed when you were 10 years old, you know? And he's like, okay, and he starts asking him all these questions. Finally, he's like, all right, fine. So Reggie leaves that night. Javon is sitting in the house. The parole officer calls, asks him all kinds of questions. What was the, what was the injury that you suffered for the last time you were incarcerated, you know? And Javon answers it all perfectly, and then he keeps all the notes in a book so he can tell Reggie what to answer next time the parole officer calls. And so he starts out by charging $5 an hour, but then his mom urges him to charge like, he starts out by charging $5 a night, and then his mom is like, no, charge $5 an hour, you know?
Yeah.
So he starts providing the service for his uncle and then another cousin. There's people selling clean urine so people can pass their parole requirements, people selling fake documents. People who work in halfway houses are allowing men to leave at night and taking an extra $100 for that freedom. And then there's all the people working on the other side for the police, sort of providing information to the police as informants. So you have this whole economy around legal precariousness or people with diminished rights.
I want to look at informants. You also describe, if I remember correctly, a janitor who moonlights as a kind of backstreet unqualified doctor, but you're wounded, go to her.
Right. So one of the things I learned is that in the police's effort to round up enough men to make their informal stats and to take in as many people with low-level warrants or any kind of warrant as possible, they go to young men's places of work and also the places like their homes become a last known address. So like all the places that young men would normally go in order to be kind of good citizens and workers and stable family members, like home, work, school, or the hospital when they are injured, that's where the police are looking for them. So in order to stay out of prison, young men have to kind of cultivate an unpredictability about their routine so that the police can't find them, which is, you know, in terms of incentives, we're setting up for people exactly the opposite of what we'd want to do. But anyway, yeah, so because the police are staking out hospitals and arresting people there, arresting black men there, running their names for warrants or pending charges, a lot of young men with warrants or with probation or parole are too scared to go to the hospital. And so I saw many young men in the neighborhood get injured and then refuse to go and then find someone who works in healthcare, either as a janitor or maybe a nurse's assistant, someone who has access to medical supplies, come and fix them, you know, like so Ronnie had a gunshot wound in his leg and bled on the couch for a few days, refusing to go to the hospital because he had just gotten home from juvenile detention and he didn't want to go back and he thought this would result in a new charge. So then his mom found a woman who was working as a nurse's as a janitor to come over and take the bullet out of his leg. So we turned up the music and he held on to a piece of cloth in his mouth and she took the bullet out right there on the kitchen table.
These are tasks that need doing. It hardly sounds like the makings of a thriving economy, but for many, it's what there is. Alice Goffman is with us. She's writing about neighborhood in Philadelphia. It is a dynamic repeated right across the country. Her new book is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. Alice, stand by. Isaac is calling from Boston. Isaac, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Professor Kaufman, thanks for your work on this. I'm a retired Superior Court judge in Boston. I teach in law school, and I want to commend you for addressing these issues, because one of the most frustrating things I saw as a judge was the what I would call the pretend life, that we were supposed to pretend that all these wonderful legal principles in the Constitution and our statute and good faith efforts were really going to resolve the problems that the professor refers to in her book. And they never do, and they won't, unless we reprioritize how we handle this kind of a crisis.
What's the crisis, Isaac, exactly? How would you define it?
Well, the crisis is marginalizing African-American and Latino youth historically for decades, not focusing our resources on what would really help, but instead focusing them on creating what has become social institutions, prisons, courthouses, and communities. And so the resources go to law enforcement and imprisonment as opposed to opportunity. And we, again, live under the pretend notion that these great principles in our Constitution are going to be enough for public policy pronouncements, like just get a job. If you get a job, everything will be fine. Or get an education. Anybody can go to Princeton. And so we live that way without prioritizing our resources in a way that really helps these young people. This is all connected to issues of race. Gender to some degree, and also the way our school systems, for example, every study tells you, Tom and Professor Kaufman, that there's more police involvement in elementary and middle schools that serve African-American and Latino youth than white kids. Get involved much more frequently. Police get called much more frequently. So you end up creating records for young people where normally in any other school system it would be dealt with different and much more kindly, supportively. So my point is that the work of the professor and you're having this on air is fantastic because it helps me raise the point that I've always made as a judge and as a law professor, which is it's all well and good to have great principles and pretend that they affect everybody the same way. It's a different thing to put the resources where they ought to be.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook. Alice Goffman and Tom Ashbrook talking about the economy of the underground people.
Judge, retired Judge Isaac, we appreciate your call very much. Thank you
so much for that. I'm just cheering over here.
What about awareness in this community where you were? Did people look around and say, this is wrong, this is messed up, this is unfair, this is unjust?
Yes, absolutely. So one halfway house operator who I got to know was letting men out at night. The people in his halfway house were, they had just come home from prison and they were sleeping way over capacity. He had problems with plumbing that he couldn't get fixed. So there was sewage on the floors, and he was letting men out at night to see their families. And he compared what he was doing to an underground railroad. I mean, he really thought that. This is about racial injustice and gross human rights violations. Mike's mother also took a very kind of political attitude. She would often say, Alice, let me ask you something. When you go to the halfway house, why is it nothing but black and brown faces staring at you from behind the glass? You know, they're taking our children. They're taking our children, and that's not right. And I think she, like a lot of people, had a lot of kind of turmoil about this because, you know, she has family who works in law enforcement, and, you know, she believes in American society, and you know, she has an uncle who was a police officer. So kind of how the system, what the system has become and what it's doing, it was a real kind of, it was hard for her to kind of wrap her head around how both of those things were happening, you know.
Let me go to Robin in New Orleans, Louisiana. Robin, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Alice Goffman.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Alice. Thank you for taking
my call.
Hi, Robin.
Hey.
So I live in New Orleans in a primarily African-American neighborhood, and I absolutely see what you're describing in Philadelphia. Kids at 13 and 14 are still kids, and then they disappear at 16. So, I have several cases of children who I've known, and they're incarcerated in a kind of non-productive state. It's not, any kind of rehabilitation, and they tend to be kids with horrible mental health issues. And having dealt with crime from, observing it, having been a victim of crime, I have actually, pointed out this kid and that kid. Without knowing what to do, really, working with law enforcement, they're dangerous to themselves. And New Orleans is notoriously sort of bad on crime and law enforcement. But it's been so disappointing because I see some of these young guys as dangerous to themselves. The law enforcement that I've dealt with tend to be African American. They seem to be harsher and less understanding of African Americans. Partially, it's almost like I feel there might be they're trying to prove that they're really hard on crime. Mm-hmm. And then nothing happens. Or just to wrap it up, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it feels like there's an attitude towards young black kids that's like thin the herd.
Thin the herd of what, Robin?
Thin the herd meaning that it's, young black kids who have any kind of poverty or mental health issues, let them fall through the cracks, and literally in New Orleans I see that they'll be murdered or they'll be lost in the criminal justice system, and there's just not there are no resources to help these kids.
Robin, our time is short before the break, but I so appreciate your call. Alice Goffman, this first-hand observation and fear of an almost, just for starters, thin the herd, just to make it easier to deal with kind of mentality there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, at the heart of this is American racism, which you know, from the work that I've done in Philly, I can tell you is alive and well. I think the question is, like, you know, how can we do better from here on out? And I think we're spending so much money on corrections, on the criminal justice system. You know, it's a lot less costly to incarcerate than it is to strengthen programs in communities, to provide job support, to help people stay in school, to help schools deal with behavior problems inside the school instead of pushing people into juvenile detention, young people. So I think, you know, right now, with budgets being very tight, that's sort of on our side. I mean, I think it's become so incredibly costly to incarcerate this many black young people and young people, period, that, you know, there's this potential for reform. But I think what has to underlie that is a sense that that African-American young people are not criminals, you know, are people who are struggling and need support.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life outside or on the edge of the law in America's heavily policed inner cities, the underground economy and culture that millions now inhabit there. Alice Goffman writes it up in her new book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us today from Philadelphia, where her research is based. Alice, let me go right to Nashville, Tennessee, if I may, and Cameron. Cameron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, for taking my time here.
Sure.
I've been personally, since I was a young adult, just coming out of my teenage years, you know, I've been in and out of the courts for like the past 6 years. You know, the better part of my, young adult life has been trying to come out from under a felony charge. And I'm to the point now where, I've got a couple months left and, it's like the pressure, it's really
on parole, you mean?
Frightening me. I'm unaware of what's going to happen, and a lot of that comes from the fact that, meeting the guidelines from these paroles and probation is too hard. I'm supposed to maintain gainful employment and pay ridiculous amounts of fees, but no other job except these minimum wage jobs in Nashville and especially in the areas where I live are the only ones that'll take me. And Nashville actually has one of the lowest, minimum wage.
Yes.
In the United States, so, it's very hard for me, someone like me who's got a little bit of an education, who, thinks well on his feet, who was in, just mixed up with the wrong people as a teenager, to really come out and battle back and try to get a leg up. For instance, when I was in the courts, as a teenager, I went through three different ROTC programs and had an opportunity to go to the military as a non-commissioned officer.
Okay.
And when I was in the courts, I pled that case with the judge, and I was like, look, hey, I'm actually a pretty good guy. Why don't you let me go, pursue the military? Look, I've got a background here saying that I'm already ready to go. And it was real, real disheartening to me because the judge looked right at me and he kind of just laughed in my face. And he said, well, my son's in the military and he would never do anything like this and denied me that right, So it's like I've had to completely change my whole, career path. What am I going to do for a job? Here I am. I'm 27 years old now, and I'm just about to reach the end of it. But, it's held me down for so long. It's hard for me to think of where am I going to make my next move. If I get out from under this, what am I going to do?
Hey, Cameron, stand by. I'm glad you called and shared that. Alice, I wonder what's going through your mind. What's your question for Cameron?
Cameron, are you 3 months away from completing parole? Is that what you mean?
I am a couple months away from completing it. As far as
congratulations, you're so close. Yeah, we want to support you and celebrate you. It's tough, and you should be really proud.
Cameron,
I really want everyone else, who's listening, who maybe hasn't called in, who might be going through it, even though I've gone through a lot of hardships, I'm about to be at the end of it. So, it can definitely be done, But
Cameron, you described fees you have to pay and you have to stay employed. If you fall out of employment, what happens?
Well, I can tell you right now, I just fell out of employment, not because of my lack of work skills or anything like that. A couple weeks ago, I was in the hospital. I do hard labor for work. It's pretty much the only field I can get work in with a felony background. But right. a couple weeks ago, I was in the hospital and was diagnosed with Sherman's degenerative disc disease, where my back just gave out and my legs just stopped working. So I'm actually walking now, but I'm coming out from that and trying to pursue careers or jobs in other fields where I don't have to put so much stress on my back. And it's just nearly impossible with the background checks that I have to go through. No one, I mean, once I get to the background part, no one takes me serious, you know, and it's just like, I've got a lot of educated people in my family. You know, I've got my two older siblings, you know, they've gone in the past, and the time that I've been in parole, they've gone from being teenagers to making $200,000 a year apiece, you know. Unfortunately, they don't live near me, and it's hard for them to lend a helping hand, you know, but I do have, on some level, some guidance from people who, you know, are going and making good things in themselves, you know, and I'm trying to get involved with people like that and latch onto those circles. And I think, you know, that's the big part of what's been getting me through it, is just me seeking out, you know, the right people, you know.
Cameron, I so appreciate your call, and I almost hate to let you go, because we can feel just how tenuous this can be, the challenges you're up against, but you're so close. Stay on the path, and we wish you very good luck on the other side, but I think you make it clear to us that there's no rosy scenario here. It's not easy on either side, but we wish you very good luck, Cameron. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, we sure do.
Cameron, thank you for calling. Good luck. I wish I could offer more than that, but we do offer that. Carol in Perrysburg, New York. Carol, you're on the air.
Okay, I'll try and make this short. Mm-hmm. And hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say that. I'm from New York and Brooklyn, and my father was in family. And I live up in Perrysburg, New York, and there's a correctional facility up here, which I volunteered, and I chaired a Narcotics Anonymous group. And all of the guys, there were two white guys, and all the rest were African-American and Puerto Rican mix. And they all came from Brooklyn, and the family that I got involved with, and one of the men, he was a marvelous musician. Some of these, they were so intelligent, and they just, you know, it's like such a waste. And the young ones always say, "Oh, I'm never coming back here." But when they go back home, and I'm talking, home was Bedford Stuy,
yep.
And the family lived in the project, and some of these families, very solid people, and good people, and the apartments were neat. But the young men they can't get jobs. And what I thought when I went down there, my father came from that area. I knew something was familiar. The sycamore trees were familiar. And I said, "Oh, my God, this is where my father was born." Mm. And the thing is, there's all these old brownstones. There's all these old homes that are crumbling. And I looked at that, and I thought, here are these young men who they had a college program in prison, and now they've cut that. And the ones that went into college were getting so proud. But anyway, what I thought was
we killed the Pell Grants in college.
So where are you going, Carol? What's your question or your observation here?
Where I'm going
here?
Is we don't have any imagination, because the young men that come out, if they come out, they're met by a drug dealer at the Port Authority at 11 o'clock at night when they get home, okay? And if there were programs where in their own neighborhoods, because these families had a pride in their apartments and but if they came back and there were programs to say, there's all these beautiful old brownstones, let's teach you how to fix up homes, that. It's staring you in the face.
Yep.
Because the neighborhoods are full of trash and barbed wire and this and that and the other thing. But
start somewhere. Carol, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Carol's thinking very practically about how to get people to work on something that would keep them out of the criminal side, which is pervasive there, out of the law enforcement side, which is pervasive there.
Welcome, sulfur dioxide. carbon monoxide. The air is everywhere. Breathe deep while you sleep. Breathe deep, 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 deep.
And now for something completely different.